Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent the views and opinions of WEFT-FM, Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WEFT Associates. And now here is this week's edition of IMC Radio News.
Why do we produce the IMC Radio News?
Because the chasm isn't left to right. It's top to bottom.
To give voice to people who aren't heard.
To bust up the myth of objective journalism.
Bill O'Reilly does not have a monopoly on the truth.
To build our community and re-educate the public.
To revive the voice of organized labor.
To bring forth debate so as to animate democracy.
Because I want to agitate for revolution.
Listen to the voices of your community on IMC Radio News.
This week on IMC Radio News, an interview with community activist John Lee Johnson. Stay tuned. In the latest installment of her Good to Know series, IMC reporter Ondine Gross talks to community activist John Lee Johnson.
Good to Know, a series of conversations with diverse members of the Champaign-Urbana community who work to build community. My guest today is John Lee Johnson, a community advocate who was born and raised in Champaign. John Lee Johnson is a man who gets his phone calls returned and his letters read. A man who has not received formal education beyond high school, but who has influenced politicians, corporate CEOs, city officials, bankers, school district superintendents, and key decision makers at the University of Illinois and at the city, state, and federal level. John Lee Johnson has dedicated his life to issues of justice and equality for African American members of our community, which means justice and equality for all members of our community. Welcome, John Lee Johnson.
Thank you for having me.
John Lee, looking over the past four decades, your work has been about access for African Americans and or low-income residents for such things as affordable housing, health care, and bank loans, as well as civil rights and equitable public school education. In what way did you find your path and purpose?
I think I found my path in the household with my parents. I was one of 13 children. We grew up in a two-bedroom home, and we would sit out in the summertime on the porch and listen to our mother sing and talk about her dreams. And one of the things that she dreamed about was having a larger house for all of her children. And I remarked that I would get that house for her. And my mother laughed and said, well, if anyone in this home will do that, you will do it. And as I grew up, I began to realize that our neighborhood was quite different from the other neighborhoods in the Champaign area. I began to ask questions, why was our neighborhood different? What could be done about it and all of that? And because I was such a talkative kid, that I used to talk all the time, gathering people around me, telling them stories. People used to love to hear me make up stories and, just hold conversations with them. And that's where I started from.
How did you find your voice and the obvious talent you have for looking past the givens and into the realms of possibility?
I think that was a gift given to me by God. I've always had the ability to see beyond that point that I was looking at. And it could be that my hunger, my love, my passion for my neighborhood, my race, for my community, always inspired me to see what was around the corner. And I've always attempted to look around the corner, to try to be ahead of the crowd, to know what they did not know, which I felt always gave me a leg up.
Where did you find the courage to use your voice to confront injustice so directly. Much of your activism started in the 60s, and this was a time in the country when police brutality against protesters was commonplace, the Ku Klux Klan would terrorize and even murder black men, and the FBI was keeping files and doing surveillance on high-profile activists, and you were frequently arrested in those years.
True. I never questioned my right to speak, to intervene. I did a lot of citizen arrest when I felt that the police was being too brutal in my neighborhood. Of course, that landed me in jail numerous times, many cases for doing nothing, but just for being there. I saw it as a right. My dad was a World War I veteran. He was an educated person. There was never any question in our home that you shouldn't do this. You know what I mean? That you didn't have a right to do this. It was almost as if it was expected. Now, I got in trouble a great deal with my parents when they had to come and get me out of jail. And my mother would say, what are you doing? You know, and I was simply saying, well, these cops were beating up this guy, and I thought that was wrong, and I tried to stop them. And she never said, don't do that. She never said that this will endanger you. So my right to speak, I thought, was given to me by my parents. And I never questioned that I didn't have a right to speak because of my race or because of the area in which we lived in. I simply spoke, and and I never thought about the risk of speaking. No one ever physically threatened me, although I was called a lot of ugly things in the newspapers and all of that. But no one ever came up to me and said, we're going to kill you, John Lee Johnson, because we don't like what you're saying, or because you're black, or because you're from the northeast side of Champaign. I dealt more with people who didn't want to listen to me and who disregarded what I was saying, as opposed to people who were threatening me. So I've always felt that, gee, I have a right to speak. And knowing that I have that right to speak has been somewhat of a courage foundation. You know, I mean, that doesn't mean I don't get nervous on occasions, but it has given me a strong foundation from which to speak.
You've actually moved some mountains in this town, working inside and outside the system. How did you gain the clout to move people, policies, and practices toward change?
Well, the old-fashioned way. I mean, I had to find people who knew more than I did and who were willing to share their knowledge with me. I didn't just blunder onto the University of Illinois. I went there, and thank God there were people who were experts on the university who sit down, who counseled me about what was possible and what was not possible at the university. There were people who gave me a thorough explanation of government. When I first was elected to the Champaign City Council, the mayor at that time, Virgil Wyckoff, gave me a long session as to how I should conduct myself without tampering with who I am. And he said, John, your responsibility is to convince us of your point of view. After a year and a half of being in this combative situation with my fellow council members, I came to grips with that and realized that the only way I was going to get something done was to convince them of that, and to convince them that my interest in government was broader than my neighborhood. I think that my ability to sway the policymakers, and I noticed in your introduction giving me all these kudos, I don't know. I think it's probably has been my steadfastness and my reluctance to turn away and my insistence that these things be done over the course of my life. And I guess that those people who know me know that this guy has done this repeatedly for over 3 decades. And not only have I done it, I've done it with some degree of success. I let other people measure the extent of that success. But I've been required to understand federal policies, state policies, local government strategies, and all of that, and how those fit with each other and with local banking policies in order to get something done.
Give us an example of how you changed attitudes. Let's take banking practices in Champaign-Urbana.
Well, in that case, I had to file interventions against the lending institutions. But it began with me first finding out what the Community Reinvestment Act was. And I needed to know that three-dimensionally, not simply by seeing something on a two-dimensional description of it. I first went to Land of Lincoln to look in the legal stacks to get an interpretation of it. I went to my congressman's office and asked that he send me anything that he had on the Community Reinvestment Act. I went to my county depository, which is a regional planning commission, which I looked through the census data for Champaign County, identified the low-income tracts of Champaign County, Then I went into the banks and asked to see their home mortgage disclosure data. Now, of course, that home mortgage disclosure data showed me that they were not making loans in low and moderate income areas. I then went into the president's office of those institutions and attempted to sit down and to discuss my concerns. In every case, they had never heard of the HMDA data. They had never heard of the Community Reinvestment Act. And by God, they did not know as a citizen that I had the authority to file a complaint against them based upon that information. And it wasn't until I began to file these complaints using all of this data that went into the regulatory agencies. And I guess our regulatory agencies had not seen, the volume of information that was associated with the complaints. I won all my complaints. And that turned the head around of the banking community to realize that this guy who came in this T-shirt, who were talking about something that they didn't know anything about at that time, that they better get busy and find out what I'm talking about. And I was able to make some significant changes in the banks, those who listened to me. I established citizen advisory committees on the Community Reinvestment Act. I extracted commitments from banks to make loans over a period of 5 to 10 years in low and moderate neighborhood areas. I developed a partnership by creating a community initiative program related to banking to give banks a lead product by which those investments could occur that would result in actual redevelopment in the areas that I was concerned with. So I became a development entity for them and a secure way in which they could make deposits to reach the neighborhood that I was talking about. And ultimately, I had to convince our local governments that they needed to become the collateral partner of the poor in a manner of securing the risk that bankers would have to make by making loans to low-income people.
This then had a direct effect on housing, and the north end of Champaign changed significantly with housing changes. Tell us about that.
Well, the housing issue all began with my mother and with being raised in a two-bedroom home and living in a neighborhood where there were no sidewalks, no streetlights, and all of that, and my vow to change the neighborhood. So I actually tore down the whole neighborhood. I really did. A couple hundred acres of land. The people who I served were as much upset with me than the people who were in power. But I did get that done, and ultimately I had to run for the city council to put the final peg on that solution. I was fortunate to work with the College of Architecture and the Department of Planning, who helped me create a community advocacy depot or a community design center in partnership with the University of Illinois. And I'm told it's the first and only design center that was owned by a community, but was staffed by students from a university, from a land-grant university in which they received grades. They did the technical part of it, and I did the political part of it. And as I always would advise the kids who came to me, that they would not see the end solution. But I promised them that the work that they contributed to our community would not go in vain, and we would actually get all of this done. And, of course, they smiled, but we did do that. So we got into the housing production building. We built 235 single-family detached. We built, I think, the second 236 multifamily housing complex in the state of Illinois, which was, at that time, Bradley Park Apartments. I forced together the Concerned Citizens Interfaith Nonprofit Housing Corporation, which were 11 churches in our community, black and white, who all joined with a committee that I had in the black community, in which we became a housing development entity. And throughout 30 or more years, I've always advocated for a strong affordable housing policy in our community and with a strong banking commitment to back that policy up.
In the end, though, when you look at banking and housing in Champaign-Urbana, didn't it end up being a win-win situation for everybody?
I think that if anyone drove through our community and they would say, carry me to the black community, because I would like to see, you measured a community by the poorest people who live in that community. I think people would be surprised of the healthiness of the black area of Champaign-Urbana. It is not a ghetto. I don't like using that term. It's not deteriorated. It's not blighted. It is a community where you can see vitality. You can see interjection of new mortgage capital. You can see development of new commercial areas along the First Street in Champaign. And all of this has come about through a group of entrepreneurs who have been committed to trying to redevelop the area and the volunteerism of the people from Habitat who have also interjected their spirit into providing housing for the poorest of the people in the in our community. So all of this has resulted in an extremely stable community, which I think increases the viability of our neighborhood in conjunction with the overall community.
What took your notice with the educational problems in Champaign and Urbana?
I'm a product of the Champaign schools, and I think that many of the opportunities that may have been denied me is a result of me being a product of the Champaign schools. I didn't really understand the value of education until we left Champaign and moved to Urbana, and I was confronted by Urbana school teachers who told me, John, what has happened to you? You know, I did a test in world history. And at that time, my world history teacher, Mrs. Lawson, who had taught during the Depression, and she was a very elderly lady, and she called me in after class. She said, John, I want to talk to you. I came in, and she gave me my test, and gee, it looked like a whole series of red marks, which were all errors. And she said, look at what you've done here, you know. And she was saying to me that, hey, you're in the 10th grade, you have very little time left, and you're going to have to make a significant turnaround. And I think that was the beginning point of telling me that I had been cheated, because the teachers in Champaign didn't shake my shoulders strong enough to say, hey, man, pay attention. This is going to be important to you. It was Mrs. Lawson that did that. And I vowed after my experiences with her to not allow this to happen to another kid, to make sure that all children knew the importance of education, that all families knew that importance, even if I had to shake their shoulders stronger than my shoulders had been shaken. And so I began to look at what we were doing and to try to figure out how I could combat it. 4 decades later, it is not better.
So let's kind of go back a little bit. First, you noticed busing practices that only bused African-American kids to schools in southern areas because the northern schools were torn down, right?
Yes. Many of the reasonable people who created our DSEC policies and all of that really didn't know what they were doing. I think there were some who understood what Brown versus Topeka, Kansas really meant and who decided that if the Constitution, if the Supreme Court was going to require an integration of the public schools, they wanted blacks coming to their neighborhood as opposed to them coming to blacks' neighborhoods. So they tore down all of our elementary schools. They did this all over America. They built elementary schools in cornfields and bused black kids to those cornfields in a mandatory process, which is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of our state constitution, of our federal constitution. Now, I would say in the main that they didn't know that because there were no constitutional experts there. It took me 40 years to find out what these policies meant and how these policies were being interpreted by the federal courts and what could be done about it. And it wasn't until I met a gentleman, Mr. Herb Stevens, who was willing to guarantee the financial means to bring our school districts into a court of justice, that we would have probably still been lingering with a haphazard DSEG policy in Champaign, in which African-American children were assuming, the unconstitutional burden of that program.
So what is your vision for the school districts? What would the end result be in that would be the best case scenario?
Well, I would love to say that the end result will be that every child will be taught to learn, but only God can do that. So what I'm really after is to eradicate all barriers to learning and to create a new partnership between the public schools and the community in which they serve.
Tell us about your radio show.
Well, I do one on WBCP, which is an African-American radio station that's in the heart of Northeast Champaign. I do that every Friday, 1 hour, and it's sponsored by BUC Bank.
What channel?
1580 AM. And I've been doing one on WFT for many, many years, which is called Higher Ground. I share a program every other Saturday. So I want to bring people a kind of discussion that they don't hear on the commercial side. And yes, it's my opinion, but occasionally I have people who are my guests who come in and present their opinion. But more than not, I speak from my community notebook. This is a large encyclopedia of knowledge that has been acquired over my 40 years of operation in my community. And I carry on this 1 hour conversation with my listening audience about things I think that are important.
You've gotten quite a few awards, and you were recently recognized at the University of Illinois in their, what's it called, Project 500?
Project 500. It's the first land-grant university to open access to African-American people. And it was not done. No shots were fired. It was negotiated in a gentleman manner between the president, the chancellor, and black students, and I from Narty Champagne.
And weren't you personally recognized even having your image painted on a mural?
Well, I mean, the artist said that's my image. I'm not quite sure because I'm in a suit and a tie. I do have a suit, but I very rarely wear that suit. My costume is generally a sweater or a T-shirt. But the point is that students back in the 60s took the mantle of our challenge to engage our community. Part of the problem in my neighborhood is that we never had an intellectual class. We never had people who were doctors, lawyers, who could look at the complication of issues and come up with a strategy for it. I mean, yes, we knew we lived in a blighted neighborhood. Yes, we knew that local government could do something about it. But we did not know how to use urban renewal. We didn't know. I mean, we didn't know the intricacies of the whole educational process until someone came and told us. And, of course, that someone was the University of Illinois. And luckily, when we went there in the 60s and we conveyed our concerns to students, African-Americans and non-African-Americans, they said, sure, we'll help you do something about it. And my respect goes to them, because all of the changes that have been made in the Northeast area of Champaign and Urbana is a result of that collaboration between undergraduate and graduate students from the University of Illinois. And it really does my heart well when occasionally they will come back to Champaign, look me up, and I drive them or ride with them to the neighborhood that was a dilapidated area when they worked on it. And I look at their face as they look around, and there's that sense of amazement on their face that this really actually got done.
They say that hindsight is 20/20. What has been your greatest regret, and what has been your greatest accomplishment?
Well, probably my greatest regret was the loss of my family. I didn't get an opportunity to be with my son as he grew up, and that was because I spent more time in the streets than I spent at home. And that happens. That happens to people in all facets of life. So that's probably my greatest regret. I don't look at the question of success because I'm not successful. There are still problems. There are still people being arrested. There are still people marred down with drug addictions. There's still illiteracy. There's still families struggling. There's still poverty. There's still indifference. There's still racism. For everything that I can turn to and say, gee, I helped that done, there's still 20 things that needs to be done. It's an ongoing process. And because I'm turning the cycle of my life, that my concerns are more, who will be left to do this? Now, even though I've spent some time thinking of that, I'm reminded that I should not necessarily bog myself down with that. Just as I think God tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, guy, I want you to go do this, that he'll find someone else to tap on the shoulder to go do that. When you look at it, it's not an easy task. There's a great deal that you have to be willing to give up, but there's a great deal of rewards for it and all of that. I think my task is just to keep working until I can't work anymore. And that's it.
You don't seem to gain any kind of personal wealth out of all this, do you?
No. I mean, people that you slap in the face are not necessarily going to make you rich. And if I would have took the time for personal gain, then I would not have been able to do some of the other things that I think I've been able to help people do.
It's helped you stay independent?
To a degree. I mean, but then not to a degree. When you look at the high cost of health in our community and in our country, then I need partnerships to pay those health bills. When you look at how do you sustain oneself, I was fortunate enough to create a partnership with local lenders in which expanding credit opportunities for them and creating a process by which that was done and which they contributed to. The challenge always is, if you're not a minister with a built-in congregation, with a built-in tithe box, the challenge always is, how do you find the financial means to sustain yourself? And if you're not at a state level or a federal level where you can get access to state or federal funds, then that is a challenge at the local level, which is why when you speak with people who do alternative radio, when you speak with people who are challenging health systems, when you speak with people who are trying to provide affordable housing and all those things, they are generally not wealthy. they're generally not the financially wealthy people, but they are wealthy in their spirits, they're wealthy in their attitudes, and they're wealthy in their serenity of life and their interaction with other people.
Very nicely said.
You give up one thing, but you gain a heck of a lot more. You know? So I wake up every morning pleased with me, and I'm able to look in the mirror and smile, and I don't see my life as a burden, and I don't get migraine headaches, and I don't worry about how long the challenge takes. It's just a challenge, and you know, I mean, if it take 20 years, it took 20 years. What am I going to do? This is my home. I started at 17. I'm 62, and I've spent almost every day of my life at this, so it's a lot have gone under the water, and it's not something that you can share in an interview, and it's not something that you can share, you know, within an hour. I always knew that what I was doing was right. I always knew I was going to rebuild my neighborhood. And I did get my mother that house before she died. She was in that house. Mm-hmm. But not only that, I got every other mother a house. I didn't forget them either. I got sidewalks, I got streets, I got new sewers, I got everything. So, I mean, and it was a little thing in my mind that said, you'll get this done, John. You'll get this done. You know, I mean, I'm very pleased that God has allowed me to see this done, as opposed to dying in my 30s or in my 40s and people sitting here being interviewed by you saying, you know, this was started by John Lee Johnson and he's not here and we did get it done. So it did get done. And yet there's more to be done. And so I'm very appreciative that of the people who have been with me, my family who's prayed for me and who stood beside me, the whole community who stood with me, because I didn't do any of this by myself. As many people who disagreed with me, there were more people who stood with me. For all of those people who meant me harm, there were more people who meant me positiveness. And so they blocked the harm. And I've been able to sustain myself in my community despite the fact that I've taken on the whole community. People treat me with courtesy, they treat me with dignity, and they treat me with respect.
John Lee Johnson, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
John Lee Johnson has worked for over 3 decades to bring tangible improvements to the citizens of Champaign-Urbana. He has served on the Champaign City Council, numerous boards and committees, and has received awards for his service from civic organizations and the University of Illinois. John Lee Johnson is a person of vision and determination who has the deepest commitment toward justice and equality. John Lee Johnson is good to know. For IMC Radio, this is Undine Gross.
That wraps up IMC Radio News for this week. Contributors included Ondine Gross. The coordination of IMC Radio News is funded in part by the Funding Exchange's Paul Robeson Fund for Independent Media. If you'd like to get involved, please drop us a line at radio@ucimc.org or call 344-8820 extension 1. Archives of this program are available on the UCIMC website, www.ucimc.org. Take care and see you next week.